idolizes feminine virginity. Rather, his love for wholeness makes virginity precious. Work, war, play, and art define ways of being in the world that cannot be reduced to any others. They bring to light features that impinge on those that sexuality reveals. It is both through them and through these erotic experiences that the individual chooses himself. But only an ontological point of view can restore the unity of this choice. Psychoanalysts vehemently reject this notion of choice in the name of determinism and the collective unconscious. This unconscious would provide man with ready-made imagery and universal symbolism. It would explain analogies found in dreams, lapses, delusions, allegories, and human destinies. To speak of freedom would be to reject the possibility of explaining these disturbing concordances. But the idea of freedom is not incompatible with the existence of certain constants. If the psychoanalytical method is often productive in spite of errors in theory, it is because there are givens in every individual case so generalized that no one would dream of denying them. Situations and behavior patterns recur. The moment of decision springs out of generality and repetition. Anatomy is destiny, said Freud. And this phrase is echoed by Merleau-Ponty. The body is generality. Existence is one, across and through the separation of existence, manifesting itself in analogous organisms. So there will be constants in the relationship between the ontological and the sexual. At any given period, technology and the economic and social structure of a group reveal an identical world for all its members. There will also be a constant relation of sexuality to social forms. Analogous individuals, placed in analogous conditions, will grasp analogous significations in the given. This analogy is not the basis of a rigorous universality, but it can account for finding general types in individual cases. A symbol does not emerge as an allegory worked out by a mysterious unconscious. It is the apprehension of a signification through an analog of the signifying object. Because of the identity of the existential situation cutting across all existence and the identity of the facility they have to cope with, significations are revealed to many individuals in the same way. Symbolism did not fall out of heaven or rise out of subterranean depths. It was elaborated like language by the human reality that is at once Mitzvah and separation. And this explains that singular invention also has its place. In practice, the psychoanalytical method must accept this, whether or not doctrine authorizes it. This approach enables us to understand, for example, the value generally given to the penis. Note, we will come back to this subject in more detail in Volume 2, Chapter 1. It is impossible to account for this without starting from an existential fact. The subject's tendency toward alienation, the anxiety of his freedom, leads the subject to search for himself in things, which is a way to flee from himself. It is so fundamental a tendency that as soon as he is weaned and separated from the whole, the infant endeavors to grasp his alienated existence in the mirror, in his parents' gaze. Primitive people alienate themselves in their mana, their totem. Civilized people in their individual souls, their egos, their names, their possessions, and their work. Here is the first temptation of inauthenticity. The penis is singularly adapted to play this role of double for the little boy. For him, it is both a foreign object and himself. It is a plaything, a doll, and it is his own flesh. Parents and nurses treat it like a little person. So clearly, it becomes for the child an alter ego, usually craftier, more intelligent, and more clever than the individual. Note, Alice Ballant, The Psychoanalysis of the Nursery. Because the urinary function and later the erection are midway between voluntary processes and spontaneous processes. Because it is the impulsive, quasi-foreign source of subjectively experienced pleasure, the penis is posited by the subject as himself and other than himself. Specific transcendence is embodied in it in a graspable way, and it is a source of pride. Because the phallus is set apart, man can integrate into his personality the life that flows from it. This is why, then, the length of the penis, the force of the urine stream, the erection, and the ejaculation become for him the measure of his own worth. Note, the case of little peasant boys who entertain themselves by having excrement contests has been brought to my attention. The one producing the biggest and most solid feces enjoys a prestige that no other success in games or even in fighting could replace. Fecal matter here played the same role as the penis. It was a matter of alienation in both cases. It is thus a constant that the phallus is the fleshy incarnation of transcendence, since it is also a constant that the child feels transcended, that is, frustrated in his transcendence by his father. The Freudian idea of the castration complex will persist. Deprived of this alter ego, the little girl does not alienate herself in a graspable thing, does not reclaim herself. She is thus led to make her entire self an object, to posit herself as the other. The question of knowing whether or not she has compared herself with boys is secondary. What is important is that even without her knowing it, the absence of a penis keeps her from being aware of herself as a sex. Many consequences result from this. But these constants we point out nevertheless do not define a destiny. The phallus takes on such importance because it symbolizes a sovereignty that is realized in other areas. If woman succeeded in affirming herself as subject, she would invent equivalents of the phallus. The doll that embodies the promise of the child may become a more precious possession than a penis. Note, we will come back to these ideas in part two. Mention is made here for the sake of methodology. There are matrilineal societies where the women possess the masks in which the collectivity alienates itself. The penis then loses much of its glory. Only within the situation grasped in its totality does anatomical privilege found a truly human privilege. Psychoanalysis could only find its truth within a historical context. Likewise, woman can no more be defined by the consciousness of her own femininity than by merely saying that woman is a female. She finds this consciousness within the society of which she is a member. Interiorizing the unconscious and all psychic life, the very language of psychoanalysis suggests that the drama of the individual unfolds within him. The terms complex, tendencies, and so forth imply this. But a life is a relation with the world. The individual defines himself by choosing himself through the world. We must turn to the world to answer the questions that preoccupy us. In particular, psychoanalysis fails to explain why woman is the other. Even Freud accepts that the prestige of the penis is explained by the father's sovereignty, and he admits that he does not know the source of male supremacy. Without wholly rejecting the contributions of psychoanalysis, some of which are productive, we will nevertheless not accept its method. First of all, we will not limit ourselves to taking sexuality as a given. That this view falls short is demonstrated by the poverty of the descriptions touching on the feminine libido. I have already said that psychoanalysts have never studied it head-on, but only based on the male libido. They seem to ignore the fundamental ambivalence of the attraction that the male exercises over the female. Freudians and Adlerians explain women's anxiety before male genitalia as an inversion of frustrated desire. Steckel rightly saw this as an original reaction, but he accounts for it only superficially. The woman would fear defloration, penetration, pregnancy, and pain, and this fear would stifle her desire. This explanation is too rational. Note, Steckel, Frigidity in Woman, which was published in French translation by Gallimard in 1937. Translation. Instead of accepting that desire is disguised as anxiety or is overcome by fear, we should consider this sort of pressing and frightened appeal that is female desire as a basic given. It is characterized by the indissoluble synthesis of attraction and repulsion. It is noteworthy that many female animals flee from coitus at the very moment they solicit it. They are accused of coquetry or hypocrisy. But it is absurd to attempt to explain primitive behaviors by assimilating them to complex ones. They are, on the contrary, at the source of attitudes called coquetry and hypocrisy in women. The idea of a passive libido is disconcerting because the libido has been defined as a drive, as energy based on the male. But one could no more conceive a priori of a light being both yellow and blue. The intuition of green is needed. Reality would be better delineated if, instead of defining the libido in vague terms of energy, the significance of sexuality were juxtaposed with that of other human attitudes, taking, catching, eating, doing, undergoing, and so on. For sexuality is one of the singular modes of apprehending an object. The characteristics of the erotic object, as it is shown, not only in the sexual act, but in perception in general, would also have to be studied. This examination goes beyond the psychoanalytical framework that posits eroticism as irreducible. In addition, we will pose the problem of feminine destiny quite differently. We will situate woman in a world of values, and we will lend her behavior a dimension of freedom. We think she has to choose between the affirmation of her transcendence and her alienation as object. She is not the plaything of contradictory drives. She devises solutions that have an ethical hierarchy among them. Replacing value with authority, choice with drives, psychoanalysis proposes an ersatz morality, the idea of normality. This idea is indeed highly useful from a therapeutic point of view, but it has reached a disturbing extent in psychoanalysis in general. The descriptive schema is proposed as a law, and assuredly, a mechanistic psychology could not accept the notion of moral invention. At best, it can recognize less, but never more. At best, it acknowledges failures, but never creations. If a subject does not wholly replicate a development considered normal, his development will be seen as being interrupted, and this will be interpreted as a lack and a negation and never a positive decision. That, among other things, is what renders the psychoanalysis of great men so shocking. We are told that this transference or that sublimation was not successfully carried out in them. It is never supposed that perhaps they could have rejected it, and perhaps for good reasons. It is never considered that their behavior might have been motivated by freely posited aims. The individual is always explained through his link to the past and not with respect to a future toward which he projects himself. Therefore, we are never given more than an inauthentic picture, and in this inauthenticity, no criterion other than normality can possibly be found. The description of feminine destiny is, from this point of view, altogether striking. The way psychoanalysts understand it, to identify with the mother or the father is to alienate oneself in a model. It is to prefer a foreign image to a spontaneous movement of one's own existence. It is to play at being. We are shown woman solicited by two kinds of alienations. It is very clear that to play at being a man will be a recipe for failure, but to play at being a woman is also a trap. Being a woman would mean being an object, the other, and at the heart of its abdication, the other remains a subject. The real problem for the woman, refusing these evasions, is to accomplish herself as transcendence. This means seeing which possibilities are open to her by what are called virile and feminine attitudes. When a child follows the path indicated by one or another of his parents, it could be because he freely takes on their projects. His behavior could be the result of a choice motivated by ends. Even for Adler, the will to power is only a sort of absurd energy. He calls any project that incarnates transcendence a masculine protest. When a girl climbs trees, it is, according to him, to be the equal of boys. He does not imagine that she likes to climb trees. For the mother, the child is anything but a penis substitute. Painting, writing, and engaging in politics are not only good sublimations. They are ends desired in themselves. To deny this is to falsify all of human history. Parallels can be noted between our descriptions and those of psychoanalysts. From man's point of view, adopted by both male and female psychoanalysts, behavior of alienation is considered feminine, and behavior where the subject posits his transcendence is considered masculine. Donaldson, a historian of woman, observed that the definitions "the man is a male human being, the woman is a female human being" were asymmetrically mutilated. Note, Sir James Donaldson, woman, her position and influence in ancient Greece and Rome and among the early Christians. Translation. Psychoanalysts, in particular, define man as a human being and woman as a female. Every time she acts like a human being, the woman is said to be imitating the male. The psychoanalyst describes the child and the young girl as required to identify with the father and the mother, torn between viriloid and feminine tendencies, whereas we conceive her as hesitating between the role of object, of other that is proposed to her, and her claim for freedom. Thus, it is possible to agree on certain points, in particular when we consider the paths of inauthentic flight offered to women. But we do not give them the same Freudian or Adlerian signification. For us, woman is defined as a human being in search of values within a world of values, a world where it is indispensable to understand the economic and social structure. We will study her from an existential point of view, taking into account her total situation. Chapter 3. The Point of View of Historical Materialism. The theory of historical materialism has brought to light some very important truths. Humanity is not an animal species. It is a historical reality. Human society is an antiphysis. It does not passively submit to the presence of nature, but rather appropriates it. This appropriation is not an interior, subjective operation. It is carried out objectively in praxis. Thus, woman cannot simply be considered a sexed organism. Among biological data, only those with concrete value in action have any importance. Woman's consciousness of herself is not defined by her sexuality alone. It reflects a situation that depends on society's economic structure, a structure that indicates the degree of technical evolution humanity has attained. We have seen that two essential traits characterize woman biologically. Her grasp on the world is narrower than man's, and she is more closely subjugated to the species. But these facts have a totally different value depending on the economic and social context. Throughout human history, grasp on the world is not defined by the naked body. The hand, with its prehensile thumb, moves beyond itself toward instruments that increase its power. From prehistory's earliest documents, man is always seen as armed. In the past, when it was a question of carrying heavy clubs and of keeping wild beasts at bay, woman's physical weakness constituted a flagrant inferiority. If the instrument requires slightly more strength than the woman can muster, it is enough to make her seem radically powerless. But on the other hand, technical developments can cancel out the muscular inequality separating man and woman. Abundance only creates superiority relative to a need. Having too much is not better than having enough. Thus, operating many modern machines requires only a part of masculine resources. If the necessary minimum is not superior to woman's capacities, she becomes man's work equal. Today, enormous deployments of energy can be commanded at the touch of a switch. The burdens that come with maternity vary greatly depending on customs. They are overwhelming if numerous pregnancies are imposed on the woman and if she must feed and raise her children without help, if she procreates as she wishes, and if society helps her during her pregnancies and provides childcare, maternal duties are lighter and can be easily compensated for in the realm of work. Engels retraces woman's history from this point of view in The Origin of the Family. To him, this history depends essentially on the history of technology. In the Stone Age, when the land belonged to all members of the clan, The rudimentary nature of the primitive spade and hoe limited agricultural possibilities. Feminine strength was at the level of work needed for gardening. In this primitive division of labor, the two sexes already constitute two classes in a way. There is equality between these classes. While the man hunts and fishes, the woman stays at home. But the domestic tasks include productive work, pottery making, weaving, gardening, and in this way, she has an important role in economic life. With the discovery of copper, tin, bronze, and iron, and with the advent of the plow, agriculture expands its reach. Intensive labor is necessary to clear the forests and cultivate the fields. So man has recourse to the service of other men, reducing them to slavery. Private property appears. Master of slaves and land, man also becomes the proprietor of the woman. This is the great historical defeat of the female sex. It is explained by the disruption of the division of labor brought about by the invention of new tools. The same cause that had assured woman her previous authority in the home, her restriction to housework, this same cause now assured the domination of the man. Domestic work thence faded in importance next to man's productive work. The latter was everything, the former an insignificant addition. So paternal right replaces maternal right. Transmission of property is from father to son, and no longer from woman to her clan. This is the advent of the patriarchal family founded on private property. In such a family, woman is oppressed. Man, reigning sovereign, permits himself, among other things, his sexual whims. He sleeps with slaves or courtesans. He is polygamous. As soon as customs make reciprocity possible, woman takes revenge through infidelity. Adultery becomes a natural part of marriage. This is the only defense woman has against the domestic slavery she is bound to. Her social oppression is the consequence of her economic oppression. Equality can only be reestablished when both sexes have equal legal rights. But this enfranchisement demands that the whole of the feminine sex enter public industry. Woman cannot be emancipated unless she takes part in production on a large social scale and is only incidentally bound to domestic work. And this has become possible only within a large modern industry that not only accepts women's work on a grand scale, but formally requires it. Thus, woman's fate is intimately bound to the fate of socialism, as seen also in Babel's vast work on women. Women and the proletariat, he writes, are both oppressed. And both must be set free by the same economic development resulting from the upheaval caused by the invention of machines. The problem of woman can be reduced to that of her capacity for work. Powerful when technology matched her possibilities, dethroned when she became incapable of benefiting from them, she finds again equality with man in the modern world. Resistance put up by the old capitalist paternalism prevents this equality from being concretely achieved. It will be achieved the day this resistance is broken down. It already has broken down in the USSR, Soviet propaganda affirms, and when socialist society is realized throughout the whole world, there will no longer be men or women, but only workers, equal among themselves. Although the synthesis outlined by Engels marks an advance over those we have already examined, it is still disappointing. The most serious problems are dodged. The whole account pivots around the transition from a communitarian regime to one of private property. There is absolutely no indication of how it was able to occur. Engels even admits that, for now, we know nothing about it. Not only is he unaware of its historical details, but he offers no interpretation of it. Note, Friedrich Engels, The Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State. Similarly, it is unclear if private property necessarily led to the enslavement of woman. Historical materialism takes for granted facts it should explain. It posits the interest that attaches man to property without discussing it. But where does this interest, the source of social institutions, have its own source? This is why Engels's account remains superficial, and the truths he uncovers appear contingent. It is impossible to go deeper into them without going beyond historical materialism. It cannot provide solutions to the problems we indicated, because they concern the whole man and not this abstraction, Homo economicus. It is clear, for example, that the very idea of individual possession can acquire meaning only on the basis of the original condition of the existent. For that idea to appear, it is first necessary that there be in the subject a tendency to posit himself in his radical singularity, an affirmation of his existence as autonomous and separate. Obviously, this claim remained subjective, interior, and without truth as long as the individual lacked the practical means to satisfy it objectively. For lack of the right tools, at first he could not experience his power over the world. He felt lost in nature and in the group, passive, threatened, the plaything of obscure forces. It was only in identifying with the whole clan that he dared to think himself. The totem, the manna, and the earth were collective realities. The discovery of bronze enabled man, tested by hard and productive work, to find himself as creator, dominating nature. No longer afraid of nature, having overcome resistance, he dares to grasp himself as autonomous activity and to accomplish himself in his singularity. Note, Gaston Bachelard, in La Terre et les Rêveries de la Volonté, Earth and Reveries of Will, carries out, among others, an interesting study of the blacksmith's work. He shows how man asserts and separates himself from himself by the hammer and anvil. The temporal existence of the blacksmith is both highly particular and larger than life. Through momentary violence, the worker, uplifted, gains mastery over time. And further on, those who forge take on the challenge of the universe rising against them. But this accomplishment would never have been realized if man had not originally wanted it. The lesson of labor is not inscribed in a passive subject. The subject forged and conquered himself in forging his tools and conquering the earth. On the other hand, the affirmation of the subject is not enough to explain ownership. In challenges, struggles, and individual combat, every consciousness can try to rise to sovereignty. For the challenge to have taken the form of the potlatch, that is, of economic rivalry, and from there first for the chief and then for the clan members to have laid claim to private goods, there had to be another original tendency in man. In the preceding chapter, we said that the existent can only succeed in grasping himself by alienating himself. He searches for himself through the world. In the guise of a foreign figure, he makes his own. The clan encounters its own alienated existence in the totem, the manna, and the territory it occupies. When the individual separates from the community, he demands a singular embodiment. The manna is individualized in the chief, then in each individual, and at the same time each one tries to appropriate a piece of land, tools, or crops. In these riches of his, man finds himself because he lost himself in them. It is understandable, then, that he can attribute to them an importance as basic as that of his life itself. Thus, man's interest in his property becomes an intelligible relationship. But clearly, the tool alone is not enough to explain it. The whole attitude of the tool-armed man must be grasped, an attitude that implies an ontological infrastructure. Similarly, it is impossible to deduce woman's oppression from private property. Here again, the shortcomings of Engels's point of view are obvious. While he clearly understood that woman's muscular weakness was a concrete inferiority only in relation to bronze and iron tools, he failed to see that limits to her work capacity constituted in themselves a concrete disadvantage only from a certain perspective. Because man is transcendence and ambition, he projects new demands with each new tool. After having invented bronze instruments, he was no longer satisfied with developing gardens and wanted instead to clear and cultivate vast fields. This will did not spring from bronze itself. Woman's powerlessness brought about her ruin because man apprehended her through a project of enrichment and expansion. And this project is still not enough to explain her oppression. The division of labor by sex might have been a friendly association. if the original relation between man and his peers had been exclusively one of friendship, one could not account for any kind of enslavement. This phenomenon is a consequence of the imperialism of human consciousness, which seeks to match its sovereignty objectively. Had there not been in human consciousness both the original category of the other and an original claim to domination over the other, the discovery of the bronze tool could not have brought about woman's oppression. Nor does Engels account for the specific character of this oppression. He tried to reduce the opposition of the sexes to a class conflict. In fact, he did it without real conviction. This thesis is indefensible. True, the division of labor by sex and the oppression resulting from it bring to mind class division in some ways, but they should not be confused. There is no biological basis for division by class. In work, the slave becomes conscious of himself against the master. The proletariat has always experienced its condition in revolt, thus returning to the essential, constituting a threat to its exploiters. And the goal of the proletariat is to cease to exist as a class. We have said in the introduction how different woman's situation is, specifically because of the community of life and interests that create her solidarity with man, and due to the complicity he encounters in her. She harbors no desire for revolution. She would not think of eliminating herself as a sex. She simply asks that certain consequences of sexual differentiation be abolished. And more serious still, woman cannot in good faith be regarded only as a worker. Her reproductive function is as important as her productive capacity, both in the social economy and in her personal life. There are periods in history when it is more useful to have children than till the soil. Engels sidestepped the problem. He limits himself to declaring that the socialist community will abolish the family. Quite an abstract solution. Everyone knows how often and how radically the USSR has had to change its family policy to balance out production needs of the moment with the needs of repopulation. Besides, eliminating the family does not necessarily liberate woman. The example of Sparta and that of the Nazi regime prove that, notwithstanding her direct attachment to the state, she might still be no less oppressed by males. A truly socialist ethic, one that seeks justice without restraining liberty, one that imposes responsibilities on individuals but without abolishing individual freedom, will find itself most uncomfortable with problems posed by woman's condition. It is impossible to simply assimilate gestation to a job or service like military service. A deeper breach is created in a woman's life by requiring her to have children than by regulating citizens' occupations. No state has ever dared institute compulsory coitus. In the sexual act and in maternity, woman engages not only time and energy, but also essential values. Rationalist materialism tries in vain to ignore this powerful aspect of sexuality. Sexual instinct cannot be regulated. According to Freud, it might even possess an inherent denial of its own satisfaction. What is certain is that it cannot be integrated into the social sphere, because there is in eroticism a revolt of the instant against time, of the individual against the universal. To try to channel and exploit it risks killing it, because live spontaneity cannot be disposed of like inert matter, nor can it be compelled in the way a freedom can be. There is no way to directly oblige a woman to give birth. All that can be done is to enclose her in situations where motherhood is her only option. Laws or customs impose marriage on her. Anti-conception measures and abortion are banned. Divorce is forbidden. These old patriarchal constraints are exactly the ones the USSR has brought back to life today. It has revived paternalistic theories about marriage, and in doing so, it has asked woman to become an erotic object again. A recent speech asked Soviet women citizens to pay attention to their clothes, to use makeup, and to become flirtatious, to hold on to their husbands and stimulate their desire. Examples like this prove how impossible it is to consider the woman as a solely productive force. For man, she is a sexual partner, a reproducer, an erotic object, an other through whom he seeks himself. Although totalitarian or authoritarian regimes may all try to ban psychoanalysis and declare that personal emotional conflicts have no place for citizens loyally integrated into the community, eroticism is an experience where individuality always prevails over generality. And for democratic socialism, where classes would be abolished but not individuals, the question of individual destiny would still retain all its importance. Sexual differentiation would retain all its importance. The sexual relation that unites woman with man is not the same as the one he maintains with her. The bond that attaches her to the child is irreducible to any other. She was not created by the bronze tool alone. The machine is not sufficient to abolish her. To demand for woman all the rights, all the possibilities of the human being in general, does not mean one must be blind to her singular situation. To know this situation, it is necessary to go beyond historical materialism, which only sees man and woman as economic entities. So we reject Freud's sexual monism and Engels's economic monism for the same reason. A psychoanalyst will interpret all woman's social claims as a phenomenon of masculine protest. For the Marxist, on the other hand, her sexuality only expresses her economic situation in a rather complex, roundabout way. But the categories clitoral and vaginal, like the categories bourgeois and proletarian, are equally inadequate to encompass a concrete woman. Underlying the personal emotional conflicts as well as the economic history of humanity, there is an existential infrastructure that alone makes it possible to understand in its unity the unique form that is a life. Freudianism's value derives from the fact that the existent is a body. The way he experiences himself as a body in the presence of other bodies concretely translates his existential situation. Likewise, what is true in the Marxist thesis is that the existence ontological claims take on a concrete form based on the material possibilities offered to him, particularly based on those that technology opens to him. But if they are not incorporated into the whole of human reality, sexuality and technology of themselves will fail to explain anything. This is why, in Freud, prohibitions imposed by the superego and the drives of the ego appear as contingent facts, and in Engels's account of the history of the family, the most important events seem to arise unexpectedly through the whims of mysterious chance. To discover woman, we will not reject certain contributions of biology, psychoanalysis, or historical materialism, but we will consider that the body, sexual life, and technology exist concretely for man only insofar as he grasps them from the overall perspective of his existence. The value of muscular strength, the phallus, and the tool can only be defined in a world of values. It is driven by the fundamental project of the existent transcending itself toward being. Part 2. History. Chapter 1. This world has always belonged to males, and none of the reasons given for this have ever seemed sufficient. By reviewing prehistoric and ethnographic data in the light of existentialist philosophy, we can understand how the hierarchy of the sexes came to be. We have already posited that when two human categories find themselves face to face, each one wants to impose its sovereignty on the other. If both hold to this claim equally, a reciprocal relationship is created, either hostile or friendly, but always tense. If one of the two has an advantage over the other, that one prevails and works to maintain the relationship by oppression. It is thus understandable that man might have had the will to dominate woman, but what advantage enabled him to accomplish this will? Ethnologists give extremely contradictory information about primitive forms of human society, even more so when they are well-informed and less systematic. It is especially difficult to formulate an idea about woman's situation in the pre-agricultural period. We do not even know if, in such different living conditions from today's, woman's musculature or her respiratory system was not as developed as man's. She was given hard work, and in particular, it was she who carried heavy loads. Yet this latter fact is ambiguous. Probably if she was assigned this function, it is because within the convoy, men kept their hands free to defend against possible aggressors, animals, or humans. So their role was the more dangerous one and demanded more strength. But it seems that in many cases, women were robust and resilient enough to participate in warrior expeditions. According to the accounts by Herodotus and the traditions of the Amazons from Dahomey, as well as ancient and modern testimonies, women were known to take part in bloody wars or vendettas. They showed as much courage and cruelty as males. There are references to women who bit their teeth into their enemies' livers. In spite of this, it is likely that then, as now, men had the advantage of physical force. In the age of the clubs and wild animals, in the age when resistance to nature was at its greatest and tools were at their most rudimentary, this superiority must have been of extreme importance. In any case, as robust as women may have been at that time, the burdens of reproduction represented for them a severe handicap in the fight against a hostile world. Amazons were said to mutilate their breasts, which meant that at least during the period of their warrior lives, they rejected maternity. As for ordinary women, pregnancy, giving birth, and menstruation diminished their work capacity and condemned them to long periods of impotence. To defend themselves against enemies or to take care of themselves and their children, they needed the protection of warriors and the catch from hunting and fishing provided by the males. As there obviously was no birth control, and as nature does not provide woman with sterile periods as it does for other female mammals, frequent pregnancies must have absorbed the greater part of their strength and their time. They were unable to provide for the lives of the children they brought into the world. This is a primary fact fraught with great consequence. The human species' beginnings were difficult. Hunter, gatherer, and fishing peoples reaped meager bounty from the soil, and at great cost and effort. Too many children were born for the group's resources. The woman's absurd fertility kept her from participating actively in the growth of these resources, while it was constantly creating new needs. Indispensable to the perpetuation of the species, she perpetuated it too abundantly, so it was man who controlled the balance between reproduction and production. Thus, woman did not even have the privilege of maintaining life that the creator male had. She did not play the role of ovum to his spermatozoid or womb to his phallus. She played only one part in the human species' effort to persist in being, and it was thanks to man that this effort had a concrete result. Nonetheless, as the production-reproduction balance always finds a way of stabilizing itself, even at the price of infanticide, sacrifices, or wars, men and women are equally indispensable from the point of view of group survival. It could even be supposed that at certain periods when food was plentiful, his protective and nourishing role might have subordinated the male to the wife-mother. There are female animals that derive total autonomy from motherhood, so why has woman not been able to make a pedestal for herself from it? Even in those moments when humanity most desperately needed births, since the need for manual labor prevailed over the need for raw materials to exploit, and even in those times when motherhood was the most venerated, maternity was not enough for women to conquer the highest rank. The reason for this is that humanity is not a simple natural species. It does not seek to survive as a species. Its project is not stagnation. It seeks to surpass itself. Note, sociology no longer gives credit to Bachofen's lucubrations. The primitive hordes were barely interested in their posterity. Connected to no territory, owning nothing, embodied in nothing stable, they could formulate no concrete idea of permanence. They were unconcerned with survival and did not recognize themselves and their descendants. They did not fear death and did not seek heirs. Children were a burden and not of great value for them. The proof is that infanticide has always been frequent in nomadic peoples, and many newborns who are not massacred die for lack of hygiene in a climate of total indifference. So the woman who gives birth does not take pride in her creation. She feels like the passive plaything of obscure forces, and painful childbirth a useless and even bothersome accident. Later, more value was attached to children. But in any case, to give birth and to breastfeed are not activities, but natural functions. They do not involve a project, which is why the woman finds no motive there to claim a higher meaning for her existence. She passively submits to her biological destiny. Because housework alone is compatible with the duties of motherhood, she is condemned to domestic labor, which locks her into repetition and imminence. Day after day, it repeats itself in identical form from century to century. It produces nothing new. Man's case is radically different. He does not provide for the group in the way worker bees do, by a simple vital process, but rather by acts that transcend his animal condition. Homo Faber has been an inventor since the beginning of time. Even the stick or the club he armed himself with to knock down fruit from a tree or to slaughter animals is an instrument that expands his grasp of the world. Bringing home freshly caught fish is not enough for him. He first has to conquer the seas by constructing dugout canoes. To appropriate the world's treasures, he annexes the world itself. Through such actions, he tests his own power. He posits ends and projects paths to them. He realizes himself as existent. To maintain himself, he creates. He spills over the present and opens up the future. This is the reason fishing and hunting expeditions have a sacred quality. Their success is greeted by celebration and triumph. Man recognizes his humanity in them. This pride is still apparent today when he builds a dam, a skyscraper, or an atomic reactor. He has not only worked to preserve the given world, he has burst its borders. He has laid the ground for a new future. His activity has another dimension that endows him with supreme dignity. It is often dangerous. If blood were only a food, it would not be worth more than milk. But the hunter is not a butcher. He runs risks in the struggle against wild animals. The warrior risks his own life to raise the prestige of the horde, his clan. This is how he brilliantly proves that life is not the supreme value for man, but that it must serve ends far greater than itself. The worst curse on woman is her exclusion from warrior expeditions. It is not in giving life, but in risking his life, that man raises himself above the animal. This is why throughout humanity, superiority has been granted not to the sex that gives birth, but to the one that kills. Here we hold the key to the whole mystery. On a biological level, a species maintains itself only by recreating itself. But this creation is nothing but a repetition of the same life in different forms. By transcending life through existence, man guarantees the repetition of life. By this surpassing, he creates values that deny any value to pure repetition. With an animal, the gratuitousness and variety of male activities are useless because no project is involved. What it does is worthless when it is not serving the species. But in serving the species, the human male shapes the face of the earth, creates new instruments, invents and forges the future. Positing himself as sovereign, he encounters the complicity of woman herself, because she herself is also inexistent. Because transcendence also inhabits her, and her project is not repetition, but surpassing herself toward another future. She finds the confirmation of masculine claims in the core of her being. She participates with men in festivals that celebrate the success and victories of males. Her misfortune is to have been biologically destined to repeat life. While in her own eyes, life in itself does not provide her reasons for being, and these reasons are more important than life itself. Certain passages where Hegel's dialectic describes the relationship of master to slave would apply far better to the relationship of man to woman. The master's privilege, he states, arises from the affirmation of spirit over life in the fact of risking his life. But in fact, the vanquished slave has experienced this same risk, whereas the woman is originally inexistent who gives life and does not risk her life. There has never been combat between the male and her. Hegel's definition applies singularly to her. The other consciousness is the dependent consciousness for which essential reality is animal life, that is, life given by another entity. But this relationship differs from the relationship of oppression because woman herself aspires to and recognizes the values concretely attained by males. It is the male who opens up the future toward which she also transcends. In reality, women have never pitted female values against male ones. It is men wanting to maintain masculine prerogatives who invented this division. They wanted to create a feminine domain, a rule of life of immanence, only to lock woman in it. But it is above and beyond all sexual specification that the existent seeks self-justification in the movement of his transcendence. The very submission of women proves this. Today, what women claim is to be recognized as existence, just like men, and not to subordinate existence to life or the man to his animality. Thus, an existential perspective has enabled us to understand how the biological and economic situation of primitive hordes led to male supremacy. The female, more than the male, is prey to the species. Humanity has always tried to escape from its species' destiny. With the invention of the tool, maintenance of life became activity and project for man, while motherhood left woman riveted to her body like the animal. It is because humanity puts itself into question in its being, that is, values reasons for living over life, that man has set himself as master over woman. Man's project is not to repeat himself in time. It is to reign over the instant and to forge the future. Male activity, creating values, has constituted existence itself as a value. It has prevailed over the indistinct forces of life, and it has subjugated nature and woman. We must now see how this situation has continued and evolved through the centuries. What place has humanity allotted to this part of itself that has been defined in its core as other? What rights have been conceded to it? How have men defined it? Chapter 2. We have just seen that women's fate is very harsh in primitive hordes. In female animals, the reproductive function is limited naturally, and when it occurs, the particular animal is more or less released from other toil. Only domestic females are sometimes exploited to the point of exhaustion of their forces as reproducers, and in their individual capacities by a demanding master. This was undoubtedly the case of woman at a time when the struggle against a hostile world demanded the full employment of community resources. Added to the fatigues of incessant and unregulated procreation were those of hard domestic duties. Nevertheless, some historians maintain that precisely at that time, male superiority was the least marked, which means that this superiority is lived in an immediate form, not yet posited and willed. No one tries to compensate for the cruel disadvantages that handicap woman, but neither does anyone try to break her down, as will later happen in paternalistic regimes. No institution actually ratifies the inequality of the sexes. In fact, there are no institutions, no property, no inheritance, no legal system. Religion is neutral. The totems that are worshipped are asexual. It is when nomads settled the land and became farmers that institutions and law appeared. Man no longer has to limit himself to combating hostile forces. He begins to express himself concretely through the figure he imposes on the world. Thinking the world and thinking himself. At that juncture, sexual differentiation is reflected in the group structure, and it takes on a particular character. In agricultural communities, woman is often vested with extraordinary prestige. This prestige is explained essentially by the new importance that children assume in a civilization based on working the land. By settling a territory, men begin to appropriate it. Property appears in a collective form. It demands posterity from its owners. Motherhood becomes a sacred function. Many tribes live under a communal regime. This does not mean that women belong to all the men in the community. It is no longer thought today that promiscuous marriage was ever practiced. But men and women only have a religious, social, and economic existence as a group. Their individuality remains a purely biological fact. Marriage, whatever its form, monogamy, polygamy, polyandry, is itself nothing but a secular incident that does not create a mystical link. For the wife, it is in no way a source of servitude, as she remains an integral part of her clan. The clan as a whole, gathered under the same totem, mystically shares the same mana and materially shares the common enjoyment of a territory. But in the alienation process mentioned before, the clan grasps itself in this territory in the guise of an objective and concrete figure. Through the permanence of the land, the clan thus realizes itself as a unity whose identity persists throughout the passage of time. Only this existential process makes it possible to understand the identification that has survived to this day among the clan, the gens, the family, and property. In the thinking of nomadic tribes, only the moment exists. The agricultural community replaces this thinking with the concept of a life rooted in the past and incorporating the future. The totem ancestor who gives his name to the clan members is venerated, and the clan takes an abiding interest in its descendants. It will survive through the land that he bequeaths to them and that they will exploit. The community conceives of its unity and wills its existence beyond the present. It sees itself in its children, it recognizes them as its own, and it accomplishes and surpasses itself through them. But many primitives are unaware of the father's role in the procreation of children, who are thought to be the reincarnation of ancestral larvae floating around certain trees, certain rocks, in certain sacred places, and descending into the woman's body. In some cases, they believe she must not be a virgin if this infiltration is to take place. But other peoples believe that it also takes place through the nostrils or mouth. At any rate, defloration is secondary here, and for mystical reasons, the prerogative is rarely the husband's. The mother is clearly necessary for the birth of the child. She is the one who keeps and nourishes the germ within her, and so the life of the clan is propagated in the visible world through her. This is how she finds herself playing the principal role. Very often, children belong to their mother's clan, bear her name, and share her rights, particularly the use of the land belonging to the clan. So, communal property is transmitted through women. Through them, the fields and their harvests are reserved to members of the clan, and inversely, it is through their mothers that members are destined to a given piece of land. The land can thus be considered as mystically belonging to women. Their hold on the soil and its fruits is both religious and legal. The tie that binds them is stronger than one of ownership. Maternal right is characterized by a true assimilation of woman to the land. In each, through its avatars, the permanence of life is achieved, life that is essentially generation. For nomads, procreation seems only an accident, and the riches of the earth are still unknown, but the farmer admires the mystery of fertilization that burgeons in the furrows and in the maternal womb. He knows that he was conceived like the cattle and the harvests, and he wants his clan to conceive other humans who will perpetuate it in perpetuating the fertility of the fields. Nature, as a whole, seems like a mother to him. The earth is woman, and the woman is inhabited by the same obscure forces as the earth. Note: Hail, Earth, Mother of all men, may you be fertile in the arms of God and filled with fruits for the use of man, says an old Anglo-Saxon incantation. This is part of the reason agricultural work is entrusted to woman. Able to call up the ancestral larvae within her, she also has the power to make fruit and wheat spring from the sowed fields. In both cases, it is a question of a magic conjuration, not of a creative act. At this stage, man no longer limits himself to gathering the products of the earth, but he does not yet understand his power. He hesitates between technical skill and magic. He feels passive, dependent on nature that doles out existence and death by chance. To be sure, he recognizes more or less the function of the sexual act, as well as the techniques for cultivating the soil, but children and crops still seem like supernatural gifts, and the mysterious emanations flowing from the feminine body bring forth into this world the riches latent in the mysterious sources of life. Such beliefs are still alive today among numerous Indian, Australian, and Polynesian tribes, and become all the more important as they match the practical interests of the collectivity. Note, for the Bantas of India, or in Uganda, a sterile woman is considered dangerous for gardens. In Nicobar, it is believed that the harvest will be better if it is brought in by a pregnant woman. In Borneo, seeds are chosen and preserved by women. One seems to feel in women a natural affinity with the seeds that are said by the women to be in a state of pregnancy. Sometimes women will spend the night in the rice fields during its growth period. Hose and McDougall. In India of yore, naked women pushed the plow through the field at night. Indians along the Orinoco left the sowing and planting to women because women knew how to conceive seed and bear children, so the seeds and roots planted by them bore fruit far more abundantly than if they had been planted by male hands. Fraser. Many similar examples can be found in Fraser. Motherhood relegates woman to a sedentary existence. It is natural for her to stay at home while men hunt, fish, and go to war, but primitive people rarely cultivate more than a modest garden contained within their own village limits, and its cultivation is a domestic task. Stone Age instruments require little effort. Economics and mystical belief agree to leave agricultural work to women. Domestic work, as it is taking shape, is also their lot. They weave rugs and blankets, they shape pottery, and they are often in charge of barter. Commerce is in their hands. The life of the clan is thus maintained and extended through them. Children, herds, harvests, tools, and the whole prosperity of the group of which they are the soul depend on their work and their magic virtues. Such strength inspires in men a respect mingled with fear, reflected in their worship. It is in women that the whole of foreign nature is concentrated. It has already been said here that man never thinks himself without thinking the other. He grasps the world under the emblem of duality, which is not initially sexual. But being naturally different from man, who posits himself as the same, woman is consigned to the category of other. The other encompasses woman. At first, she is not important enough to incarnate the other alone, so a subdivision at the heart of the other develops. In ancient cosmographies, a single element often has both male and female incarnations. Thus, for the Babylonians, the ocean and the sea were the double incarnation of cosmic chaos. When the woman's role grows, she comes to occupy nearly the whole region of the other. Then appear the feminine divinities through whom fertility is worshipped. A discovery made in Susa shows the oldest representation of the great goddess, the great mother in a long robe and high coiffure, which other statues show crowned with towers. Excavations in Crete have yielded several effigies of her. She can be steatopygous and crouched, or thin and standing, sometimes clothed and often naked, her arms pressed beneath her swollen breasts. She is the queen of heaven, a dove is her symbol. She is also the empress of Hades. She comes out slithering, symbolized by a serpent. She can be seen in mountains, woods, the sea, and springs. She creates life everywhere. If she kills, she resurrects. Fickle, lascivious, and cruel like nature, propitious and yet dangerous, she reigns over all of Asia Minor, over Phrygia, Syria, Anatolia, and over all of Western Asia. She is known as Ishtar in Babylon, Astarte to Semitic peoples, and Gia, Rhea, or Cybele to the Greeks. She is found in Egypt in the form of Isis. Male divinities are subordinated to her. Supreme idol in faraway regions of heaven and Hades, Woman on Earth is surrounded by taboos like all sacred beings. She is herself taboo. Because of the powers she holds, she is seen as a magician or a sorceress. She is included in prayers, and she can be at times a priestess like the Druids among the ancient Celts. In certain cases, she participates in the government of the tribe, and at times she even governs on her own. These distant ages have left us no literature, but the great patriarchal periods conserve in their mythology, monuments, and traditions the memory of times when women occupied very high positions. From a feminine point of view, the Brahmin period is a regression from that of Rigveda, and the latter a regression from the primitive stage that preceded it. The pre-Islamic Bedouin women had a much higher status than that accorded them by the Quran. The great figures of Niobe and Medea evoke an era when mothers, considering their children to be their own property, took pride in them. And in the Homeric poems, Andromache and Hecuba have an importance that classic Greece no longer granted to women hidden in the shadows of the gynecium. These facts all lead to the supposition that in primitive times a veritable reign of women existed. This hypothesis, proposed by Bachofen, was adopted by Engels. The passage from matriarchy to patriarchy seems to him to be the great historical defeat of the feminine sex. But in reality, this golden age of woman is only a myth. To say that woman was the other is to say that a relationship of reciprocity between the sexes did not exist. Whether earth, mother, or goddess, she was never a peer for man. Her power asserted itself beyond human rule. She was thus outside of this rule. Society has always been male. Political power has always been in men's hands. Political authority, or simply social authority, always belongs to men, Levi Strauss affirms at the end of his study of primitive societies. For men, the counterpart, or the other, who is also the same, with whom reciprocal relationships are established, is always another male individual. The duality that can be seen in one form or another at the heart of society pits one group of men against another, and women